Good morning. What's up, everybody? It's good to see you. And I'm really honored and humbled to be up here talking with you, sharing a little bit about what we've been thinking and doing in some parts of the United States around these issues. I want to start out just with some acknowledgments. I want to acknowledge the creative spirit in the world that brings us together, that connects us to each other, to the natural world, to the animals and plant life. I want to acknowledge the earth that we stand on, that nurtures and supports us, that we often forget about. I want to acknowledge the Maori people whose land this is, and stand here with respect to them. I also want to acknowledge the movements for social justice in the United States that have inspired and guided my work, the movements of working people, movements for civil rights, the women's liberation movement. And I also want to acknowledge my own Jewish foreparents who have taught me so much about both survival and social justice. We do this work, we come together to talk about and work on social justice issues on the shoulders of those who have come before us. And so I want to just kind of bring some of those people into the room this morning. I also want to acknowledge my children and the other children in my life, because we also do this work for the generations that come. And it's important that we bring them into the room as well. So I invite you to think about who are some of the young people in your life that you do this work for, that inspire you and guide you. With that said, we're here to talk about social justice. I need to just say a few sentences about the context we're in, because we're in a world that's at war. There's war in Iraq, there's war in Afghanistan, there's war in the Congo, there's war in the Middle East, and Aceh, Colombia, the Philippines. And that means that when we're gathered together to talk about ending violence, we're doing it in the context of war in many parts of the world. But we also have wars not just out there in other countries, but in our own countries, both in the United States and New Zealand. And that, I would call that a class war. We have increasing inequalities of and concentration of wealth in this country. And that means that there's war on women and children. There's war on people with low income. There's war on recent immigrants and people of color. And each year over the last 20, 25 years, the amount of wealth in this country has been more and more concentrated. And that means less for the rest of us, less going into the services that would actually help us eliminate the violence in our society. So we need to acknowledge that that's the context that we come together with. My colleague Neil Myhan often talks about the tree of violence, and I want to just hold this up here for a moment, because I think it's an important context for thinking about the work that we do. And in the tree of violence, the branches of the tree of violence are incidents of interpersonal violence. Don't worry if you can't read this, I'm going to go through it. The different kinds of interpersonal violence: fights, domestic violence, sexual assault, hate crimes, drug abuse. And many of us have jobs pruning the branches of the tree of violence, responding to the incidents of family violence or sexual assault or child sexual assault. What happens when you prune a tree? It grows back, doesn't it? And a healthy tree is one that's pruned and grows back more healthily and more foliage. So if we're serious about uprooting the tree of violence, what's the only way to uproot a tree is to dig at the roots, right? And so what are the roots? Well, they're economic inequality, they're racism, they're sexism, homophobia, what we call adultism, the systematic oppression of young people. So we really have to look at, what are we doing? Are we serious about uprooting this tree of violence? Are we just pruning the branches? Are we just responding to the individual incidences and just providing social services? Or at the same time, are we digging at the roots? Are we doing what we call root work? We have to do this work up here. We're getting paid to do it. People are in devastating circumstances. They need our support. But unless we're also doing the work at the bottom, the root work, we're not serious, in my mind, about ending violence against women. Now, the opposite of a tree of violence is a tree of life, right? So what would the quality of our relationships be like if we were creating a tree of life in our communities? Well, there would be safety, there would be equality, there would be the valuing of difference, there would be love, there would be respect, there would be a lot of different qualities, and I'm sure each of you has your own image of what the tree of life might look like. But then we have to ask ourselves, well, what would be the roots of that tree of life? What are the systems that we need to be in place to support that? Well, we would need housing, affordable housing. We would need jobs that provided a decent living. We would need safe and healthy, non-environmentally toxic neighborhoods. We need health care for everyone. We would need systems in place, institutions and organizations that provided the nourishment and support and foundation for the tree of life. So we have to ask ourselves, not only what are we doing to uproot the tree of violence, but we also have to ask ourselves, what are we doing to build a tree of life? What kind of work are we doing to build the communities that we want to live in, so that we have a vision of that? And I think in this work, doing it over the decades, it's very difficult to maintain a vision of what we want to achieve, because we get bogged down in the daily reality of responding to people who are suffering. So I want to spend just a couple minutes with you thinking about what does it mean to have a vision of a world that's safe for women and children and men. So I invite you just to sit in your seat for a moment, and I'm going to have us think about for a moment what it would be like if the world, if New Zealand, of our communities, were completely safe for women, children, and therefore for men as well. So first of all, think about our workplaces. What would be different if every workplace all of the time was completely safe for women, for children, and for men? What would be different? How would it feel? How would it look? How might your life be different? And then think about our families. What would it be like if every single family member all of the time was safe? How would your life be different? How would it feel? How would it look? And think about our classrooms and our schools. What would it be like if every child was safe all of the time at school, on the playground, in the halls, in the classrooms, going to and from school? How would your life be different? How would your children's lives be different? And finally, think about our streets and neighborhoods. What would your life be? How would things be different? How would your life be different if it was completely safe for every woman, every child, every man, all of the time in our communities? And just notice any feelings and thoughts you have. What's it like to reclaim a vision of safety in the world, freedom from fear? Because very often we get to a point where we no longer hold that vision, that image of what it means, what we're really trying to accomplish in the long term. I think one of the things that we have to do if we're really serious about doing work about ending the violence is we have to seriously look at the economic system. And so I want to just do very quickly look at not only the economic system, but where we are inside of it. And I've done a pyramid to represent the population and wealth of New Zealand. Those of you who are in my workshops are familiar with this by now, I think. And I'm just going to put a couple of figures up here. 10% of the population of New Zealand controls greater than 50% of all of the wealth of this country. The houses, the cars, the buildings, the land, the stocks and bonds, retirement funds, all of that stuff. And at the bottom of the pyramid, 50% of the population is struggling to divide up 3% of the wealth. Well, you can see what this does. When more and more wealth is concentrated at the top of the pyramid, it means more and more people are struggling to get by. It means there's more and more tension in our relationships, in our workplaces, in our communities. It means that we don't have the money to support the programs that we know work. It's not like this is rocket science. We know what will make safe communities. If we had lots of money, we could transform our communities and lots of other kinds of resources. But with all of this concentration of wealth at the top, then we're struggling just to take care of ourselves, just to keep our organizations alive. And one of the things that's true is that the people at the top of the pyramid don't want to deal directly with people at the bottom, so they've created a buffer zone. And these are the occupations and professions and careers and jobs to take care of people at the bottom of the pyramid, to keep hope alive for people at the bottom of the pyramid, and to keep control of this pyramid and maintain it and make sure that things don't change very much. And many of us have jobs in the buffer zone because those are the jobs pruning the trees. That's what we get funded to do. Not to make change, not to actually end violence, but to provide services for the victims so that it becomes standard that there are victims, there are batterers. We come to kind of assume that that's going to continue. And so we have a choice in the buffer zone of two different kinds of approaches to doing this work. One is we can try to help people get ahead. We can try to get ahead ourselves. And the second is we can try to help people get together. And we can get together ourselves. And I want to speak about that just for a little bit because I think that's the core of rethinking what we're doing so that we not only provide social services, but we also provide the foundation for social change work. And I'm going to give two different examples. One, if you're a teacher in a classroom, you can try to help each individual student get ahead. Try to meet their educational needs, figure out how they learn best, what kind of material is appropriate, so that they can move on into a college, into a training program, into a job, whatever. Each one by one. And when we first started doing work with youth in the schools, that's what we tried to do. We tried to get each individual young man not to hit his partner, and we tried to get each individual young woman to be skilled and able to take care of herself and stay safe. But if you're really trying to help them get together, then you realize that young people are a community in that classroom or that at school, and that they need tools for being able to talk to each other, for being able to communicate across their differences, for being able to identify the problems in their classrooms and schools, and to come together and come up with the solutions that they need. And so that's the added level of helping them get together so that they're actually equipped and empowered to work together to solve the problems that they face. Another example is from the battered women's movement. We can see each battered woman, each survivor that comes into a shelter or into a program as an individual who needs support. She needs safety, she needs some housing, she needs childcare so that she can get back on her feet and out into the community and get ahead in her life. One by one. Or we can see the women who come into our shelters as potential members of a battered women's movement who not only need those survival skills and that safety, but need to know how to work together, how to become a part of a movement. They need to know the history of the battered women's movement and the history of how people have come together. They need to have the opportunity to sit with other battered women and reflect on their experiences and the common causes of those experiences. They need to be invited into a movement and given opportunities to be involved and to make a difference. If every woman that came through one of our programs, every man who came through one of our programs, all the children in those families became members of a movement to stop male violence would end. But what we do instead very often is we help them each one get ahead because we're not thinking about creating a movement. We're thinking about individual success, individual survival. So I think that this is a real key question we have to ask ourselves. Are we helping people getting ahead? And are we helping them get together? Because if we're not helping them get together, then we're not building the momentum, the foundation of a movement that's actually going to end violence in our society because we can't do it alone. Those of us in this room are not enough. Those of us doing the work who are paid to do the work are not going to be enough. We need to have a broad-based, organized movement. I just want to say a couple of other things. I want to give an example of a couple of organizations in the United States that are doing work that I find very inspiring. So I want to share that with you because they are trying to help people get together. One is a group in New York of young women of color called Sister to Sister. It was started in the early to mid 90s by a group of young women in their 20s in a neighborhood of New York. And basically what they decided was they wanted to make their neighborhood safe. The houses, the streets, the schools in that neighborhood, they were tired of being at risk. They were tired of being attacked and harassed. They were tired of seeing families broken up by violence. So they started reaching out to other young women. They started having discussion groups. They got lots of different kinds of projects going. They started having cultural events in the neighborhood to bring in young people and to raise issues of family violence, sexual assault, dating violence, things like that. And they got successful enough that they started to attract some foundation funding. And by the late 90s, they were kind of fashionable. And so they had quite a bit of foundation money, and they were spending a lot of time writing grants and filling out reports and assessments and evaluations. And pretty soon, the work that was their passion, that was their community work, was just work. It was just another job. They didn't want to do it. It was completely uninspiring, and they weren't able to continue doing the creative work that they had started out doing. So they made after much discussion, and this was a really difficult process because they had a substantial budget and several of them, a lot of them were getting paid to do this work at this point. They made a decision to stop raising money from foundations in the government. Now that is a really remarkable decision because that meant that a lot of them were not going to be paid to do this work, that they had to rethink how they made this work happen with a lot of community people, volunteer time, part-time, semi-paid time, but it freed them up tremendously to get back into their neighborhoods and do the organizing that they wanted to do. And they've come through that transition. They're still doing remarkable work, but they are not in the traditional nonprofit kind of NGO kind of situation where they are dependent on the funding, where they're spending much of their time raising money, writing grants, you know, all of the stuff that we do to keep our organizations going. So that's one example of one kind of really different way to think about this work and stay true to the roots of the organizing basis of it. The other group that I want to share a little bit about with you is a group in California on the other side of the country called Gen 5, which is short for Generation 5. This is a group of women who have come together to end child sexual assault in the next 5 generations. Now, that is a remarkable vision just in and of itself, right? To have a 125-year vision of the work that you want to do. And their work is to do the work of the first generation that lays the foundation for the work of those who come after them. And that's what they're about, trying to do the educational work, the organizing work, the training work, so that the next generation of leadership comes around and we can build on that. Now we, I think in the domestic violence movement, are in the second generation, or we're on the cusp of the second generation. We have laid a tremendous foundation. And yet, for there to be a second generation, first of all, we have to have a long-term vision of what that means, and second of all, we have to be training the leadership for that generation. And so one of the things that's really important in doing this work is to think about, how are we bringing young people into this movement? How are we mentoring and inviting young people to do this work? And how do we think about it in terms of what kind of foundation are we laying? If we continue to do what we're doing for the next 10 years, or 15, or 25 years, what's going to be different? What kind of foundation will be there? Are we doing something that's commensurate with the challenges that we face? In the United States, it took 250 years to abolish slavery. It took 150 years after the Constitution was signed for women to get the right to vote. We need to see this work in long term. We need to understand that we may not see the goals that we're working for, but unless we have that vision of a world safe for women and children and men, we're not going to be moving towards it, and we're not going to be thinking strategically about how to lay the foundation for the next generation. And I think that that's really important. And the way the foundation is to come back is getting people together, organizing at the grassroots level. So I think questions we have to ask ourselves, each of us and together collectively, the first is, what is our vision? The second is, given that our vision is to end violence against women, what is our goal? What are the concrete goals that we're trying to achieve in this generation? What are the strategies we're using? And then what is our individual roles in that? And this is not an individual process. This is the process our organizations should be going through. This is the process we should be going through with members of our communities so that they're involved in this process. What's our vision? What's our goal? What's our strategies? And what's my particular role in that? And the question is, are we helping people get ahead? Are we helping them just get together? Or are we helping them actually transform the community? Are we holding out a vision that people want to join? Are we offering people an opportunity to step in and participate in ways that make a difference? Finally, I just want to leave you with a quote from my Jewish heritage, from the 5th century Rabbi Tarfon. He said, "It is not upon you to finish the work, neither are you free to desist from it." And for me, that means that for each of us, we have to define what our goal is, and we're not going to be able to do the whole thing, but we each have a piece of that. We each have a really important role in that. So I'm going to leave you with that. Hopefully, I look forward to talking with people more for the rest of the day, and use me as a resource. Very much in the United States, we're struggling with these same issues. How do we get beyond a social service model that actually speaks to the real serious needs of our communities? Thank you very much for the work that you do.